This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and we're back again coming to you from our birthday party, and the effects of the birthday party have sunk in, which was illustrated by our almost 1 minute of silence before starting this episode.
Just waiting for Jon to find that inspiration to launch into the intro there.
Actually, no, it was a 9-year-old Alzheimer's. I totally thought you were starting the episode.
Oh, dear.
Ah, well, hey, it's fun, and it should be fun, because it's still our anniversary 1 week later, so this is the fun part about being a one-episode-a-week podcast, right? If your party runs late, it's a whole week of anniversary. That's great.
Indeed. Birthday cake all round.
It is bad for the body mass index and sobriety, perhaps, but it's a bit of fun.
Indeed. Speaking of a bit of fun, we have the second part of our interview with Jon Murtagh, the Linux Foundation, and different topics coming up next, including, well, lots of fun stuff.
Yeah, and actually learned something new here. The first topic we're going to talk about, I didn't even realize that had changed that way, so I mean, that's why we do this, right?
Indeed it is. So without further ado, let's jump into part two of our birthday celebration interview with Jon Murtagh. Yeah, so I mean, if that's the first of the ones that you've been helping out with, like what else is on the dabbling agenda?
So we've been dabbling and working with the Open API initiative. So you might have for many of you who are in this space, you might have heard of things such as Swagger. The idea here is, defining APIs publicly is can be a mishmash of things. And the idea of the Open API Initiative is, hey, if we can build some general standards around the tooling half of things, how these things are publicly defined, how all of that can be sort of consumed in, there's definitely efficiencies of scale that begin to happen, but then also you have tooling vendors and things like that. They can take advantage of it, which helps sort of the developer, productivity end of it come in there. So really that's really what Open API is. It's like, hey, let's define a standard for describing APIs, of how they can be well described out there. So they're basically building a standard around an API description language, which just opens up all of those other pieces. So you're not spinning your wheels or trying to figure out how I describe it. You have a language that you can do it in, that you already have an ecosystem of things that connect into. So that's kind of really what their main focus is.
And is obviously the goal is, ideally everyone would use this, but sort of, as you say, Swagger has been around for a while. What else? I don't even know. Like, what else is out there at the moment that is sort of, why wouldn't people just adopt Swagger for everything? Or like, what's the focus for this?
So, the interesting thing is that is seen in API in application development. Is that the core application is developed, and then there's the requirement as well, we have to have an API. So that sort of gets slapped on at the end. and it's a bit of an afterthought. And I think where this group wants to kind of get the mentality in there is that you're almost starting at that API definition first as a part of your application, and then you're sort of building backwards from there, because as we've moved more to like service-oriented architectures, the API is sort of the glue that fits all of this together. So if that isn't something that's not only well constructed but also has abilities to be well understood by various tooling, whether it can be consumed very well and things like that, that ends up being a lot of inhibitor. So if you look at sort of the competition to this is somebody just kind of like having some sort of non-standard way of doing this, because it's an end requirement of, I need to have an API. So here we go. So this is sort of a little bit of that, like, hey, why don't we live within a structure that exists? Like, let's live within an industry standard that we can all align on, because once you do that, you take advantage of all of these other things that are there.
It's funny, the number of times where like products get released and like the API only covers part of the functionality, or maybe Terraform support, but the Terraform only covers some of the things that the users want to do. And unsurprisingly, people pick up on that stuff really quickly. Like, oh great, I can do this or this and this, but what about this? And it just, there's if you've got something, and I get that some things you may not want to expose through APIs if you've got a very specific reason, but in a lot of cases developers like run out of time, or maybe do the bits that they think are important and don't necessarily understand how users are wanting to use these things. Making sure that you understand what your definition of done is, I think, is a really, really important thing before releasing something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, the more thing that we start to see is, what is that developer experience look like? And, there's so much tooling investment that is happening to help enhance that, to make developers much more productive. I mean, we're seeing a huge amount of that on the AI space, Copilot and things like that, that are getting into sort of like the code generation, code suggestions, code optimization, sort of aspects. But then, these pieces here are just sort of adjuncts that are helping folks be more productive. So if you're developing an application, hey, I need to pull in this API from this other service, if it's already open API compliant, or it's using that as sort of its standard, that's an easy thing that it knows how to observe in. All of your code hints and typing kind of works nicely alongside it. You can manage versioning so much easier. Like, there's just the tooling is already there to sort of accelerate your development and kind of make that a lot easier for you.
Well, for me, the main advantage of having a Swagger behind it is that it usually comes with auto-documentation. So actually a web page you could go to and see what the calls are and kind of be able to deduce usually there's a bit of text there as well, some metadata around it, but typically you could kind of learn what it did, because good documentation or API is very boring, very hard to maintain, and typically not very good. And this kind of makes it document as you go, which makes it again very useful for reuse and integration with other things. So as a part-time developer, sometimes I enjoy these little things in life.
It's the little things. And it lowers the barrier to getting that, because we all know, as developers, what is the least favorite thing we all love to do?
Security.
Okay, after that.
Sorry, I was
going to be documentation. It's got to be documentation.
I mean, you're not wrong, John, at all. But after that. and it's hard. And so having like tooling that just kind of like helps keep all of this, connected together. I mean, we've seen so much on like where like Read the Docs has made it so easy for you to kind of have like code documentation and things like that, and having ways to expose that. We see this is just kind of an adjunct within there that just helps the developer productivity move along. So I see that this is a group that's kind of like expanding into like looking at like what other areas from the API lifecycle could be looked into. What are other areas where standardization can be important? So we're just seeing a lot of convergence beginning to happen right now, especially with the advent, with AI becoming so important. Many of the interactions that you're having with them are going to be dependent upon sane APIs to work with. So if an API just becomes a more and more important part of that glue infrastructure to make that all happen.
Yeah, I've also seen in the past that having good API can help you become the standard. Because if you have a good, well-described API, people will, I can just reuse that and hook into that. And that's actually very good for a project to sustain itself, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, those are some of the. I mean, there's a bunch of other little ones that I'm working with here, but those are two that I find that we don't hear a ton about, unfortunately. And so I think, you know, for listeners, if you're those are kind of interesting spaces, you know, definitely go check them out.
Nice. Well, speaking of ones that we don't necessarily hear about. How about one that we heard a lot about recently? The ASWF got a nice little article in the Register not too long ago.
Yeah. David Morin, who's our executive director, did a great talk at the Ubuntu Summit a few weeks ago. And, you know, this was a really, really good article of just giving a brighter look at all of the open source that is happening to make visual effects work. Because, you know, so much of that industry is really dependent upon software. But so much of the production pipeline is dependent upon these open source projects that have really come together in the Academy Software Foundation. To really drive forward, you know, some of the work. The easy one that I always talk about is OpenVDB, which is, you know, if you're in a movie and you're seeing a simulated explosion happening, that's thanks to OpenVDB. That is the library behind helping create that. You know, a lot of the color matching and which color across very different mediums you would think is really simple, but it is a very opinionated, challenging problem. You know, tooling like OpenColor.io is a core piece of that, you know, functionality in there. You know, Material X, we're starting to see around, you know, material shading and things like that is becoming, I mean, that sort of came out of Lucasfilm and some of the work that's happened in the, that they've built as part of sort of the last sort of part of the Star Wars movies that came out of several years ago. Some of that technology has become a really core component that we're seeing out there and driving some of this forward. So, you know, you don't sort of sometimes think about this industry as much of open source, but I will say this is one of the ones that we are seeing so much interesting collaboration happening, and even in non-traditional ways, like, you know, we see organization, we see groups that are in the, you know, online sales space that are leveraging these tools for being able to do of like, hey, how does this object fit in my room? Like, what does it look like in there? Being able to do really interesting things like that. So, yeah, had a really great article. If you haven't, definitely go check it out. I mean, yeah. If the Register writes a nice article about you, you must have done something right.
Yes. Indeed. And there was even, I love the fact there was even a little nod at the end of the last paragraph to a mention of Jon's favorite company, SGI, at the end from their, you know, where they spent a lot of their time back in the day. But it's amazing to see, you know, Linux and open source making such a huge impact in, you know, modern day special effects and cinema and that sort of thing. It's just the thing I love most about the article is probably like there's a few different like short video clips. I think they're sizzle reels or something like that for each of the different projects as you go through. And it's just like the special effects are just amazing. And, you know, I just... It breaks my brain a little bit to think about the fact that this is all being done with open source software. I don't know why that breaks my brain, but I just think it's just really cool.
I mean, and the funny thing is so much of that is sort of like the reason why this collaboration has come together is because the idea of VFX is almost an expected piece of this industry. Like, it's not as much of a different. I mean, okay, James Cameron with Avatar. That's a whole different like thing. We're going to toss them over onto the side there because that's like, you know, there's a lot of special stuff that happened there. But I would say for the vast majority of this, the commonality of these tools, like the VFX, is really just part of the story that gets you there. And really where, you know, these studios really want to have their heavy investment is on things like, you know, actors, stories, things like that, the things that are really become start to differentiating a part of that. VFX is just like part of how you get there. And so the more that, and the talent around understanding these areas is there's just not a ton of it out there, which is, again, I think an interesting challenge that the industry is trying to kind of work through is like, how do we grow the next color scientist that knows C and C++ really well? And how do we sort of build sort of those competencies, which I think these projects, by bringing them into open source, are actually democratizing and getting more of that interest in, because you have people that are interested, but they never saw an inroad into this industry. So it's really interesting. It's like open source in one half, it's like, okay, yes, it's very cool that it's enabling this. Yes, it is a thing that is kind of bringing together these studios and different groups to save costs. But I think the other angle is it's opening up new entrants of talent to come into this industry where they might not have saw an inroad before, which is a great segue into this lovely t-shirt that I'm wearing here. I set that up
well,
didn't I?
Tell us about it.
So the summer learning program, the Academy Software Foundation is doing this for a number of years, and the idea is how do we get individuals and groups, especially from underrepresented communities, to get involved in this industry and find out how can we get career opportunities and things like that. So they work and mentor, learn about the industry with them. They collaborate and work on some of the projects and other work in there. And they walk out of it with a better understanding of the industry, but B, also connections. And those lead to potential job opportunities for them, which, I mean, mentorships and things like this are like a core tenet of a lot of our projects. But I think for this one especially, it has demystified your path into this industry.
Yeah, because I mean, in the bad old days, if you wanted to get into, VFX work, great. Like, you need to go and get a $20,000 license for, proprietary program X. Like,
yeah,
okay, I'll just go and do that to see if I like this potential job or this potential career change. Mm-hmm. Like, just not feasible.
Yeah, no, it's not. And then also just being able to then say, okay, I want to get into this, but I don't even know what the opportunities are, what it's like. You're putting all this investment into it and then just kind of like hoping something ends up at the end, which, I mean, and honestly, like, I think so much of tech had suffered from that, which is what open sources came in and just opened the Komodo up on, is like, how can I get involved in these things and see if this is something I really, really, really like? But then on top of it, build up the experience, the resume, the portfolio, so that I can go in and, find career opportunities out of that. We see time and time again that like companies that are depending upon like, open source, projects and communities and these projects are critical to their business. When they're looking to hire talent, they go into those communities to look. Like, that's where they're going to, because they have a higher track record of success in there. But also for them, it's like, okay, we have somebody that we know understands this, that can continue to help this investment grow, for us. And so that's in a way like solidifying, so much of that.
Yeah. I mean, the way that this has evolved over the last, handful of years, I just think is just incredibly cool. And to see, this area kind of opening up, like open standards, open software, and it opening up, no pun intended, opportunities for people as well. Like, that's just the cherry on top.
It is. Yeah. It is. I mean, that was, one of the things in the Open Mainframe project that is always the thing that sticks out to me the most was the first year we ran a mentorship program, and we brought some of our mentees to a conference called Share, which is probably the oldest tech conference out there. It was started in the 1950s. Share is a community as a whole. Everything in open source, we should thank Share for, because they were sort of the pioneers in this space. The whole idea of what Share as an organization is to share knowledge share code, share things. I mean, back in the 50s, it was probably on, you know, punch cards and microfiche and things like that. But it was that same spirit of where we're after comes from those communities in there. So we brought these students to share. And it was just so fascinating watching them of how excited they were, how much of interesting, cool stuff that they worked on. And just, you could just sort of see, like, they're kind of at the beginning, they just walked away, like, we didn't even realize this was here. Like, we didn't realize there was an entry point into this ecosystem. And this has opened it up. You know, also at the same time, that community was so excited. It's like, oh, wow, we have young people here, quick. Let's you know, open up the wall. But in all seriousness, like, the power of open source within these communities, it gives you that entry point that you might not have had. And that is always, you know, when I think about my work with these communities, it's times like that when you see these people get in and they have success. Those are the things that are just so amazing to see. And summer learning programs are a great example. Like, these folks that are having success and find their way into this industry because of investments of open source, it makes it all worth it.
Awesome. Well, I mean, we've obviously been chatting for a little while here, but before we wrap up, like, is there anything fun sort of going on in the not too distant future? Anything that you're excited to, you know, share that's coming up?
Oh, there probably is. So I know we're still working on our open mainframe project of getting our mainframe resource up, a lot harder than we anticipated. We have done some cool announcements on that project. One, which is kind of related to the AI space, is a new project launched called Zorce, which is basically helping data sets of COBOL code along with benchmarking tools, which the goal is to enable code intelligence and optimization tooling that would leverage AI. Because one of the biggest challenges, I mean, the biggest challenge with AI right now is good data, like by far. I mean, you can build all the great models in the world, but if you don't have anything good to train it on, you're just going to end up with, you know, not great models in the end. So that is one big area of focus that they're after. And then they're looking to evolve into some of the other mainframe languages, because they're ones that are just, you know, not a lot of COBOL code on GitHub. You know, there's not a lot of Rex code. There's not a lot of PL1 code out there.
The good stuff. A bunch of floppies with COBOL code if you want it. I mean,
true. Right? That's the problem. Maybe we should have asked John. He had it all locked up for us. But so that's one area that is a big area of focus. And then another project they launched is called ZOpen, which is focused on basically creating. The best way I can describe it is homebrew for ZOS. So being able to install open source tooling, dependencies, things like that, and manage it on ZOS, along with the work that is going in those upstream communities to help support ZOS, you know, in those there. So those are two real fun project areas that we're starting to see emerge there. On the LF Energy side of things, that has been an area we just continue to see a lot of interesting, you know, collaborations, especially between power systems operators and different vendors there. One project which I think is one to me that I'm very bullish on for our society as a whole is, you know, focus is a project called Trolley, which is focused around transmission line ratings. One of the biggest challenges that we are seeing out there is there are less and less places to put high tension wires. But with things like AI again, the need for power is increasing and increasing and increasing, which is why often when you're seeing data centers built out, you're seeing them built out in a lot of rural areas, because they can at least have ways to transport power into there. But with that, with electric vehicles, like, the stress on the grid is becoming more and more and more. There's one challenge on the generation side of things, but the real weak link in there is on the transmission lines. Like, you can only push so much through there. So what that project is aiming to do is help build rating systems with the idea that higher capacity training transmission lines can be built. So you're not needing to put up new towers. You can instead increase the capacity of what you already have in, you know, in a safe and documented way. So that's one there to really, really keep an eye on, because I think that is really the pinch point that we're seeing in there. And we're just going to kind of see more and more. I mean, I think energy costs are going to be increasing because of the demands on the grid. But like I said, they're the one of the weak links that we're seeing in there is on the transmission line side of things. So that's a project that's coming together to help define that. So that's a really, really interesting place. We're seeing more and more on the EV charging, some projects in there like Everest that are helping standardize, you know, various pieces up there. And we're seeing a lot of different governing organizations and different, you know, municipalities that are looking to kind of, you know, help roll out and use some of the charging technologies that they're building out there. And, you know, we're seeing also a lot there in the grid prediction area. You know, being able to kind of have smarter ways to sort of understand where the stress points on the grid are at and how to optimize and work with them. And there's a numerous amount of projects that are tackling that from different angles, from forecasting to severe weather prediction, or at least not severe weather, like knowing where the severe weather is, but like, what does the stress on the grid look like when those events begin to happen? So a lot of great stuff there. And I would just say also on the security, on the open source security front, the OpenSSF is just continuing to do great work. You know, they've really done a lot of investments on the package manager ecosystem and helping build up so there's much stronger provenance of understanding where those packages come from, how they're built, being able to trace all of that all the way through, which connects to like SBOMs and things of that nature. But, you know, because more and more, I mean, you know, how much of the software that you're installing on your computer is, you know, a pip install or an NPM install and things like that. And being able to know that the artifact that I am getting through that is the artifact that I intended to get is really, really important. Because we just see, you know, bad actors and things like that that are coming into the fold that, you know, disrupt so much of that. So, you know, there's a lot that's going to be continue to happen to that space over the next year and beyond because of just, you know, a lot of the challenges that just need to kind of help come together to make that much more sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, security is going to get more important because you mentioned the year of the Linux desktop before, and I think it's going to be 2026.
You know, it's good that you didn't say 2025 because then you would just fall into the trap that everyone does. If you say 2026, now you look like a trendsetter.
Yeah, but I have a reason for 2026.
Okay, what's that?
Windows 10 goes out of support. And Windows 11 is causing for a lot of old hardware no longer being viable unless you go to Linux. And I've actually, in my broader bubble of people, a lot of people are actually starting to look at Linux as a desktop OS because this is just a stumbling block. It's a reason for people to look at it, and that's kind of what you want. You need some kind of momentum happening. So Microsoft, for good or for worse, whatever, is causing this now, and having a secure backed open source solution available also, because we still have a lot of people thinking open source is that safe. I mean, if you're in the world, you know it's safe, but for the typical Windows user that uses it for, I know, doing the Facebooking and things like that, that's good for the reputation of the whole project, the whole environment.
And to be honest, like a lot of that infrastructure, we talked a little bit about like Windows support and stuff. Like a year or two ago, I built a gaming PC for my son, and you know, we built like an AMD, you know, Ryzen like 5900 Xbox, you know, whatever. But we installed Arch on it. And to be honest, like Arch with Steam on it, he's able to run games better than he could on Windows 10 or 11. Like, especially he likes the game Roller Coaster Tycoon, which is a hilarious one to build a gaming PC to play Roller Coaster Tycoon. but the thing is like how much work has went into being able to support so many of those different APIs and then also scaling them in a performant way. I mean, it's actually a really good, I mean, the Steam Deck is basically, that's what it is under the hood. It's like a Linux box, you know, that's in your hand. And so I, John, you're not that far off. I do sort of wonder here. I mean, personally, I like those Windows 10 machines going out because then I can use them for my Plex server at home because they can do hardware transcoding on the Intel CPUs. But I do see on the desktop side of things, I mean, it's improving. It's cleaning up quite a bit. And you're just seeing so many of these different OSs that really anybody can use.
And you see mainstream media also start to pay attention to it. I mean, like 3, 4, 5 years ago, if you knew the YouTubers that you wanted to follow, yeah, you had some tech YouTubers. But nowadays, how to put Linux on your PC is becoming kind of a normal thing to do. It normalizes the whole concept for people, which again is important.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're not just a trendsetter, John.
I predicted the chatbots everywhere 7 years ago. I'm predicting Linux Desktop 2026.
I wish you could take the chatbot and sing back.
Yeah.
I never said it was a good thing.
That's not one to claim your fame to, bud.
It's not something to be proud of.
I'm joking.
I predicted hell. It was there. I'd rather be good at predicting bad things than bad at predicting good things. Well, maybe not.
Yeah. I don't know. Good things are things like lottery numbers. So like that would actually be useful.
No.
Anyway.
Many big lottery winners are not happy afterwards.
This is true. Money doesn't buy happiness.
No.
Sadly. Although I wouldn't mind trying.
Does.
Maybe money doesn't buy happiness, but Linux does. Maybe that's the new slogan.
No, Linux lets you make your own happiness.
Right.
Because you're
right.
In a community, you help people. Ta-da.
Right, okay.
Well,
as a Linux on the desktop user for over two decades, I welcome all the new people to Linux on the desktop. It's a wonderful place to be.
Well, I'm going to try to join you the next year.
All right, well, John, thank you as always. It's been an absolute pleasure. And we'll catch up again soon, I'm sure.
We definitely will. Thank you all very much. I'm excited to do another year of this. Hopefully we have not lost the entire audience at this point. There's at least like two people left that can, you know, make proof that we got to this point. But in all seriousness, I truly enjoy doing this. This is a lot of fun. And I'm hoping this kind of gives everyone some interesting insight and thoughts into what the world of open source is looking like.
Hope we don't have to wait another year for you, so you have to write another book and publish it in 6 months or so we can get you on the show again.
Maybe. I don't know. That seems like a lot of work. This one here was it's a labor of love, but has been very... Let's put it this way. If you buy this book and you're thinking, oh gosh, you're helping John be a millionaire, you're not. If you want to be a millionaire book writer, you become a billionaire first and then you write a book.
Yeah.
Unless you're Stephen King. That's maybe your exception.
Well, he didn't really write a book.
He wrote a couple.
He wrote like a book a week at some point.
I could imagine doing that. Like this one here, like getting through some of these chapters, because like the delivery schedule, it was like a chapter like every like 2 weeks. And it's a lot. It's a lot of like mentally, because you have to be like in the mental zone. And when you're in the zone, like you can ramble on forever. Now you go back and look at it and you wonder what the hell you were thinking.
That's for the editors, that's somebody else.
Is this really coffee? Like, you know, like, it's a challenge. But I look back at it, like I've read a couple books before and I look back at them and I'm like, I don't know how proud I am of those.
It's an achievement.
This one here, I feel like I have a lot of pride in. Like I look at this one and I cannot be ashamed of showing people like, hey, this can be a very useful book. It will age, but and there's already some things in there. Like if I've ever asked to do a second edition, I would go and dig into, especially on business cases, because one of the interesting things that I think started to spur in some conversations of within organizations, like one of the hesitance of companies contributing to open source is they're thinking that like once they put their employees on it, they're going to be stuck with this thing forever. which is kind of fascinating. It's like, it's an angle I've just never thought about, of like having that like not liability, but you know, just like that level of commitment that you're going to be with it. And I've even seen that in like some of the communities I work with, of like, you know, leaders of people wanting to step up and get into like maintainer roles and things like that. Like the biggest hesitation is like, how do I get out? Like, what is my exit path? Which is a crazy thing to sort of think about. But I mean, you know, we're all gentlemen at a point in our careers that we are not the young ducklings anymore. Hi. And we're, I mean, John, he's just turning 29. But the rest of us, and I think we all realize that when you start to invest in so many of these things personally and professionally, like letting go of that or having a path to doing something else is a hard thing to do. And so I see that a lot of like communities I work with. It is a huge struggle point of, I would love to step up as a maintainer. I'd love to step up as a leader, but I don't see how I'd ever get out of this thing. Anyways, there I go segueing again.
It wouldn't be an interview without with you without many, many segues. It's one of the things we love about them.
Well, that's at least good. And I also noticed none of you disagreed with me on the getting out of open source half of things. So we're going to, sounds like that's an intro. And I don't know, like, how do you get out of that? Like, what are your, I mean, I have my own theories, but like, what are your thoughts on like, how do you make that as a path that somebody could feel like I can get involved for a while, but I have a path out?
I mean, some of it I think is almost like succession planning.
Yeah.
Or at least like building enough of a community around you that you're no longer a single point of failure. I think that to me has always been a big part of it, making sure that something is, you know, in a sustainable state, you know, if things are going to live on and be productive when you step away from them, that's the, in my mind, at least, that's the best possible outcome.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
For me, it's a non-issue because I don't think like that. If I go into something, it's because I want to be into that thing, and I can't envision a moment when I don't longer want to do that. If I would ever think I want to do this for a little while and then I need to get out, I wouldn't even start it. And I think a lot of open source committers are in that same boat where they just are enthusiastic and start doing it without looking forward. And then, yep, you're totally right. You're locked in. You're never getting out again.
Yeah. And I think you just realize the reality of what that means. Like, it's cool to be excited about the space, but then you don't realize like what the reality of all that is. I mean, in life, not everything is happy. And you have to find ways to find joy in things. And joy doesn't always mean that it's roses and sunshine and butterflies. But joy is at least that you can see like the bigger picture, and you can see like when it all comes together of a lot of excitement of it. You know, and I think that's it. So you're probably not wrong. And I probably have a lot of personal identification to that too, of like, I want to be conscious that if I'm getting into something that I'm doing it sort of, I'm not doing it for like an emotional investment. I'm doing it for like a practical investment, and I could see myself doing it for a while in there. But I think it's one half of the person, but I think it's also another part on the community side of things. So I think also there's a community lean, and it's like, oh, we have a new maintainer. Great. Now we can all lean into them. And that's the aspect that doesn't come together. Like, I have a couple of communities that we've been working on where like some of like the leadership roles, we actually time box quite a bit and saying, hey, look, like if you're a project chairperson, you're that for a year.
Yeah.
And it forces the community to be also thinking about that as well.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Protect people from themselves. It's very needed sometimes.
Yeah. You just don't know what you're getting into. I mean, and it's not that it's bad. I mean, I feel like if you're a listener and you've made it this long, you're like, oh shit, John, you've talked me out of open source. This is like a hellish show. But it's not. There's so much joy. There's so much, you know, interesting stuff that comes out of it. Your ability to connect and meet with people and know that you're making an impact on things that are bigger than you is absolutely fascinating. But the weight of that is where you don't understand what that is until it happens.
Yeah. And it's not just open source. I mean, 9 years ago, we started a little podcast and we haven't gotten out of it anymore.
Yeah, no one else will take us up on taking off our hands.
Yeah, you can't get any of these big podcast networks to like get into it or anything like that, which, you know, and then if you did that, then they'd say you're selling out. And then you'd be like, no, I'm not really selling out because selling a podcast doesn't get you much money other than paying dinner for the next night.
Yeah.
Sound like definitely. Writing a book. You want to be a billionaire making podcasts? Become a billionaire first and then make a podcast.
Yeah. 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 The podcast bubble economy has broken. Everyone here is now doing it because they just love it, which.
Exactly.
Yes. Which is the thing we're talking about.
You know? Anyways. See, we were closing the show.
That was a point.
One final segue.
Yeah. Listeners, you thought you were getting out of this, but no.
Well, in that case, here is the closing.
Final.
John, thank you as always for your time. Really appreciate catching up with you, finding out what's going on in the world of the Linux Foundation, all of the many and varied projects that you touch there. So, yeah, thanks again, and we will chat again soon.
We will. Thank you all.
Thank you for just being fun.
I mean, honestly, we might as well have fun with all of this. Like, that's the best part. And thank you all for being fun and you know, tolerating all of the segues and things like that, because most people will be like, you know, pulling the hook out and saying, okay, John, time to go. Like, you know, here you go, Grandpa. Like, you know. But thank you all. This has been a lot of fun. We'll do it again here soon.
Definitely.
Cheers.
And that concludes our birthday celebrations, 9 years of the Roaring Elephant podcast, and 429 episodes. We made it. And we will be back next week for, I guess, probably episode 430. That's usually how numbers work. Anything else from you, Jon?
Nope. Great discussions again. Thank you very much to John Murtig again for being such a wonderful guest on the podcast. And I can't wait for him to write that second book so we can have him on again.
Oh, don't do him like that. But yeah, always good to catch up with John. So much always going on. And yeah, just a really wonderful person to chat with. So thank you again, John. Really appreciate it. But that is unfortunately all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. We're also on YouTube. So if you want to see our happy, smiling faces, you can like, subscribe, even comment and do all the YouTube things. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and for more information about the podcast. And please send any feedback to podcast@roaringelephant.org or indeed comment on the YouTubes. Until next time, my name is All Birthday Caked Out Dave.
And my name is Where is a Strong Black Coffee? Jon.
And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then.